Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Mayor Triple Threat looking for some assistance. Still looking for assistance. $15 billion city budget, as we discussed when we tackled this topic yesterday. And a proud, out and proud sanctuary city, county, state is Illinois. All the resources. And when I talk about the city budget, that's just the city budget proper. That doesn't contemplate all the nonprofits that suck at the teat of the government as well. All that money, all that infrastructure, and 125 migrants shipped up from the southern border through Texas to Chicago, that overwhelms the system.
It's a joke, and she knows it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, I'm just trying to be rational here. If 125 people overwhelms all of those resources, then doesn't stand to reason maybe you need to rethink your sanctuary city policy? Because if we're welcoming to all the world over, no preconditions, then we best be prepared to have the the resources to treat them humanely, and apparently we don't.
Well, that's what the
just a practical problem.
Yeah, but I asked her, like, you saw them get off the bus. They were on a nice chartered bus, air conditioned, with a bathroom and food and water. They were so pretty. This wasn't inhumane.
Well, actually,
it was not at all. They were so happy to be here.
Actually, Allie Bradley from News Nation, which is one of these startups that sort of tries to play it straight. They've got center left and center right. I mean, if you call Chris Cuomo center left, which I don't, I call him Fredo and way left. But nonetheless, some decent reporting happening there, including from Allie Bradley, who actually did track some of the buses that had started in Texas and wound up in D.C., wound up in Nashville, wound up in Chicago, actually talked to some of the migrants, including Hector from Venezuela. And by the way, you'll love what the migrants are calling Governor Abbott.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, Nicole, you're exactly right. Now, Governor Greg Abbott is actually being referred to as El Transportador. That translates to the transporter. That's what migrants are telling me. They're also telling me that they're extremely grateful and extremely happy for the help getting closer to their families.
A greeting days in the making. 51 migrants arriving in Washington, D.C. early Saturday morning. A church charity immediately helping. One migrant got off in Nashville, ending his journey on the bus chartered by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, saying he was tired of traveling and just wanted to make it to his family in New Jersey.
I feel happy, sad, because I am alone here. My family is very far away, but I feel fine because I try help in the future.
And while many of these migrants are linking up with family or friends, this man made the choice to leave some of his family back in Venezuela.
Thank God for bringing us here.
He was praying as soon as he got off the bus.
They may, I feel, protection and feel human people around me. All different. Where I coming?
Do you know what respect is? Did you feel respected?
Yes, a lot of respect. Respect and partnership is more important for any people. I feel that here, the human, you know, world, the union, the more important the life I feel here.
Hector says they were fed on the bus, a 39-hour trip with 9 stops along the way.
Bring to us all things we need, water, food and crackers and chips and anything.
And movies.
Yeah, movies a lot.
Not exactly the Trail of Tears.
Exactly. Here's Jose, who came here from Venezuela to Chicago. Here's how he's doing.
En la selva de perder la vida.
The fear here is dying in the jungle or in the Rio Grande. The biggest fear is that you'd lose a child. You're judged when you put your kids in danger, but there was no alternative. And while they assimilate to life here in the U.S., this becomes their new temporary home, the Salvation Army. Here they can finally get some rest as they search for some normalcy. We know not everyone will want us here, and there are people that aren't happy with us being here, but we will be respectful of their opinions and do anything to gain their trust. We just ask they give us a chance.
Well, the interesting thing is, it turns out from some of this reporting that we find out that Governor Abbott is actually being fairly surgical about who he sends where, because you're hearing about migrants that are connecting up with family or friends that they have in cities around the country. So, yeah, he's focusing on sanctuary cities to call the bluff of the new Marxists, like your Lightfoots and your Adamses and your Bowsers, and to raise attention to what's happening at the border. And that's all well and good. But he's also doing it, it turns out, shocking. I know this will be shocking for the propagandists, that he's doing it in a quite a humane way.
Yeah.
He's respecting the process. If they're asylum seekers, that this is up to the federal government, not him. He's making the provisions necessary for safe travel. And he's also got a mind's eye to where people have networks of support that they can lean on.
Because 22 of the people that came to Chicago out of the 125 have family in neighboring states, so they came to Chicago, and then their family members came and got them. So, and also
they're not sending criminals.
Engineer, two are mechanics.
Well, she's overwhelmed. Chicago's overwhelmed.
I asked her about that.
So over the weekend, when the second busload of people came here from Texas, you said instead of having to guess who's coming, who's not, how many, and what are their needs? That's what mayors along bordering states and the governor of Texas have to deal with on a daily basis. So why not call on the federal government, President Biden, to try and work on border security?
When you're in a border city, a border state, exactly who's coming and when, although I think the intelligence on that has approved. But this is entirely within the knowledge of the Texas governor, who he's putting on buses, when they're coming, what their specific conditions and needs are. So the same thing he's saying, hey, I need more help. Well, so do we. He's treating these human beings like freight. And like, we don't need to know exactly what's what so that we can make sure that we have proper accommodations for them. All this is about is a manufactured political crisis. It doesn't need to be this way. If he really wanted to show leadership, leadership would be saying, regardless, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and I'm going to then cooperate with the cities and towns and states that I am sending people to. There could be a lot of collaboration that works to the benefit of these poor souls that in many instances have been on the road for months seeking refuge from violence, from lack of economic opportunity, from starvation, all the vestiges of poverty and violence that we see, unfortunately, happening in home countries. We all should be on the same page.
Yeah, and then they come to Chicago and they're right back where they started. Here's the thing. She talks past the issue.
Always.
Governor Abbott, they have to deal with this at the border. Well, we have to deal with it, too. They're dealing with a scale you can't even contemplate, as evidenced by the fact that you're overwhelmed. The city of 2.8 million people and a $15 billion city budget is overwhelmed by 125 migrants spread out over a couple of days, according to her. According to the mayor.
So what she wants.
I'm sorry. The question is, why wouldn't you show the leadership you're suggesting Greg Abbott show and isn't showing, and say to your friends in D.C. and get your mayors together, collaborate, get Jelly Belly on board, collaborate, and send the message to D.C. Hey, you have to provide for security at the border and an orderly process and collaborate with local and state authorities in those border states so that their problems are not visited upon cities like mine.
I mean, they go to Washington, D.C. all the time.
Both ways, as always. It's a burden to her and somebody that is offloading a infinitesimal part of their burden to her. They're the bad guy. She's not the bad guy. Never the bad guy. And she's not responsible for everything. And to the extent that somebody is doing something she doesn't like, racist.
And according to Alderman Lopez, who is running for mayor, I have talked to him extensively. He said she knew they were coming. Texas let them know to be prepared for a few busloads right now. So she knew, and she's acting like, no, Amy, I didn't know.
It doesn't
I just
matter.
Want to have a conversation with
Governor. It doesn't matter if she knew or she didn't know. You're telling me.
Well, she's making vilifying.
You're telling
him.
Me the mayor of Chicago doesn't have at her fingertips social service agencies as well as actual city resources to provide whatever assistance you want to provide to whoever you want to provide. For God's sakes, you're sending out $500 checks per month to 5,000 Chicago residents as part of your universal basic income expansion of the welfare state pilot program.
Well, she's asking for private donations.
Of course she is.
Public donations.
Because they want to posture as overwhelmed. We're being inflicted upon by evil border states, evil Republican people. They don't never say anything about New Mexico. But evil Republican people in places like Texas, particularly Greg Abbott. They're imposing on us because they don't like the other. They're afraid of brown people coming from other countries. None of it's true. Mm-hmm. It's all sophistry. It's an endless series of straw man arguments. It's endless deflection, as you heard there, where she won't answer the question. She won't apply the standard she wants Greg Abbott to abide to the President of the United States, with the federal government having primary responsibility for border security and federal immigration policy. No. Won't tackle that topic because she's a hack. At the end of the day, she's just another political hack. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
No, there's billions of dollars sitting around in COVID money that hasn't been used, and they have it. They just don't want to get rid of it. As far as the situation, the federal law states that when the illegals come over, it's catch and release. So send them to her. And also, there's soup kitchens all over the place in Chicago. I see them. People are being fed. And there's more than enough food for these 125 people.
Of course, there's nobody starves. Nobody starves through lack of access to food in this country. I mean, it's just a ridiculous proposition because of the multitude of nonprofits that are available and the resources that we have, and the way that they are frittered away. I mean, you could put everybody up at the peninsula for the weekend, for God's sakes. And by the way, they're not all coming here. You know, they're not coming here starving like they just swam across the Rio Grande. As you heard, they're being taken care of from the time they are encountered by border security to the time they're processed and then bussed out by Greg Abbott. You're hearing from them, actually.
Yeah, well, they all said they saw health care professionals before they got on the bus. So two of them needed to get, you know, minors. They've been taken care of the whole way.
And then in addition to that, because of what we now have a better appreciation of, you know, they're connecting with family and friends who can provide, you know, shelter and clothing and food and so on and so forth for them while they await their asylum, the adjudication of their asylum application or what have you, you know, and that's a whole nother topic, I understand. But the idea, 125 and it's, you know, a humanitarian crisis. 2 million since Mr. 10% has been in the Oval Office. That's not a humanitarian crisis. What we see intermittently at the border, under bridges, what was it, 500,000 Haitians not so long ago? That's not a humanitarian crisis because of the open borders crowd of which Mayor Triple Threat is a part. Okay. Right.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the special master appointed to review the federal government's review of the documents they seized from President Trump's residence, Mar-a-Lago, issued a 24-page order this week that contains some interesting, factoids. It is an opinion not without controversy, before we get to the facts. Both our friend Andy McCarthy and former Attorney General Bill Barr thinks that the appointment of the special master was a mistake and that the federal government would win if they chose to appeal. And also, on the specific matter of executive privilege, because that's one of the issues that's being addressed and is addressed in the 24-page order, the issue of executive privilege in particular with respect to the documents. Attorney General Barr, former Attorney General Barr, makes the point that this was a premature decision about executive privilege. In point of fact, the Monday order tackles the topic of executive privilege. In opposing Trump's request for the special master, the Biden administration argued that Trump lacked the right to assert executive privilege against the current executive branch. The court disagreed, saying that the Biden administration's position arguably overstates the law. The Supreme Court has not ruled out the possibility of a former president overcoming an incumbent president on executive privilege matters, and the judge, the special master, Aileen Cannon, who is a Trump appointee. She wrote, further, just this year, the Supreme Court noted that at least in connection with a congressional investigation, the questions whether and in what circumstances a former president may obtain a court order preventing disclosure of privileged records from his tenure in office in the face of the determination by the incumbent president to waive the privilege are unprecedented and raise serious substantial concerns. So the question is, does his privilege extend beyond his term, even if there's a disagreement between the previous president and the current one over the assertion of executive privilege? But Barr argues, and he offers a hypothetical he did yesterday with Martha McCallum on Fox, a hypothetical to sort of frame this. And, this is a bit esoteric legal business, but it's important in terms of understanding the dynamic at play right now and the jousting between the two parties, the president's legal team and Biden's Department of Justice.
Let's say a document has the DOD secretary recommendation on strikes against a hostile nation in retaliation for something. We should bomb X. That is potentially privileged if someone outside the executive branch tried to compel its production, like Congress or a grand jury. But that's not where we are. Number one, that document clearly is not the president's. It clearly goes to the archives. Number two, the judges just acknowledged that it can go to the intelligence community to assess the damage. The reason that's not a problem under privilege is because it's not going outside the executive branch. The question presented here is one she doesn't even address, but it's the only issue really in dispute, which is, can a former president say that this document, an executive privilege, precludes executive branch agents who are looking into whether a crime was committed from reviewing those documents? It's too early to say that they're going to try to put those documents before a grand jury. There's no contemplation right now or proposal to put it outside the executive branch. So her decision is premature. And the dispute isn't over whether this document is executive, potentially executive privilege, and this one isn't. That's not the dispute. The dispute is whether the president, even if it is executive privilege, can the president bar DOJ from reviewing the documents? And the answer to that, I think, is clearly no.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. But even if that's what Barr lays out is the proper legal judgment, and even if that's what President Trump did in mishandling classified documents, even if that's something that occurred. And that there's still this question that's pending that we don't have an answer to, because there have been representations made by Trump loyalists like Kash Patel, the former chief of staff at DOD, that he declassified the information that he took. And this was not asked of Barr. It hasn't been addressed by those who have the opinion that Bill Barr just articulated about the documents themselves, that the contents are a sort of a secondary issue because they're not looking to present the contents unredacted to the grand jury. The issue is, does executive privilege cover him for taking possession of those documents, of classified documents that are more properly under, well, that are properly under the control of the National Archives.
But if they declassified those documents, why doesn't his attorneys come out and say that or present that in court?
Well, again,
I'm still waiting to hear that, and that hasn't happened.
Well, that's the question. If what Kash Patel and some others have suggested is true, and I think it was Kash who said, you know, I was there when he said I'm declassifying said documents, then I don't know why that hasn't been asserted publicly, because it seems to me that would be game, set, match if he declassified them and it was in his power to declassify them while he was still president. So that is curious. In addition, let's get to something that, but before we even get to that, get something else, because I want to go back to Barr. Now, you heard Barr's opinion, and the supposition is that government has a pretty good case on the handling of classified documents if indeed they were not declassified. But here's Barr's opinion about any prosecution of the former president.
I think that even if they can technically make the case, that there's another step, which is prudentially, do they want to do it? Because it's a former president and its impact on the country. I hope they don't do it. But, you know, the law here, I think, is pretty clear. That the Justice Department should be able to review these documents. If it got to the point where they wanted to actually put the documents before the grand jury without sanitizing them and protecting the deliberative process, then you would litigate the issue. But for her to come in now in sort of this abstract thing and say this guy is going to decide what is potentially privileged dodges the question, which is, does the president have standing to assert the privilege against the existing administration?
And you heard my reference in her order. The her is the special master. My reference in her order on the matter of executive privilege, and she believes it's not the settled issue that Bill Barr is suggesting it is. I guess maybe not settled issue, but she doesn't see the same predicate that Bill Barr sees as necessary before making a determination. Okay. Fine, there's a disagreement. But even if it is, you heard Barr say, it would be imprudent to prosecute for all sorts of other reasons.
Well, but in the meantime, why are they? Who in the world is leaking stuff from DOJ to the FBI to reporters? You know, this morning, like, a document seized was very sensitive and may have, you know, nuclear, a mystery country's nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
The drip and drab keeps going. Come on.
Something else here, too.
Who's the leaker? Stop it.
Margot Cleveland picked up on this over at The Federalist in terms of Biden's involvement, since Biden, learned about the raid.
Sure.
The same way we did from TV, had no involvement in this.
Just like you and me.
There was a May 10th letter in which the National Archives informed Trump it would proceed with providing the FBI access to the records in question as requested by the incumbent president, beginning as early as May 12th of 22 of this year. So May 10th letter. Informed Trump it would proceed with providing the FBI access to the records in question as requested by the incumbent president, beginning as early as 2 days later. The letter explained Biden had deferred to the archivist's determination in consultation with DOJ regarding whether or not the archivist should uphold a former president's executive privilege. Here we go again. But we'll provide the FBI access to the records in question as requested by the incumbent president, beginning as early as Thursday, May 12th. So that means he, being Biden, didn't just defer to the National Archives. He asked the National Archives to give the documents to the FBI, which is basically outsourcing the handoff of said documents to the National Archives. And so it suggests involvement by President Biden that he suggested did not exist. Does seem to exist, doesn't it? Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Deliberative process. I think the FBI blew that deliberative process when they leaked that information. Whatever happened to not commenting on ongoing investigations? And then secondly, just a shot, Dan, what do you think this foreign government with nuclear capabilities, Ukraine, possibly? Is that why they're so hot and heavy on this? Just a shot. Prediction.
No idea. Thanks for the call. And this, you can't look at this and make this assessment without the context of the previous standards the FBI has set with respect to the handling of sensitive government documents. Obviously, Hillary Clinton comes to mind. You also can't make an assessment of this without including the conduct of now retired Timothy Theobald, who was the point man who allegedly buried evidence, the point man in the investigation to Hunter Biden, who was assigned by the Washington field office as the point man to manage whistleblower Tony Bobulinski, who you remember did the long extended couple of interviews with Tucker Carlson before the election, Hunter Biden's former business partner. Bobulinski spent 5 hours secretly being interviewed by the FBI on October 23rd of 2020. 2 weeks before the election, about his inside knowledge of then-presidential candidate Joe Biden's involvement in his son's business deals with China, reports Miranda Devine, the New York Post. And this is after he had revealed at a press conference the big guy and the 10% cut in terms of the Chinese energy firm and that venture with Hunter Biden, gave the FBI contents of 3 cell phones containing encrypted messages between Hunter and his business partners, along with emails and financial documents detailing the Biden family's influence peddling. And the point person, Timothy Theobald, who was the target of a whistleblower himself, he was one of the agents named in that letter that was sent to Chuck Grassley that he raised the last time Chris Wray was on the Hill testifying before the Senate committee. He spiked it, basically. Mm-hmm. And so considering the agency and the agency's history, particularly with this former president, and particularly in comparison to their handling of this former president's political enemies, first Clinton Inc. and then now Biden Inc. It's difficult to look at this as just a sterile matter of law. It really is. The law is important, and if Trump violated the law, then that should be acknowledged, and corrective action should be taken. So we'll see. We'll see, because we know some things, and we don't know a whole bunch of other things. And there are differing legal opinions about things like the special masters we're going through with Barr versus Judge Cannon. Pour it all over it all. But we live in a time where you are prosecuted or not prosecuted in many jurisdictions, not just D.C., but in many jurisdictions based on your political beliefs. And so given that's the culture that the left has imposed on the nation, and half the country cheers it all the way along until it turns on them, and it will. You cannot look at this. You cannot make an assessment of this without factoring in the political context. To do so would actually, to not do so, factor in the political context, that would be irresponsible. To pretend that this is just a matter of black letter law would be irresponsible. Frank in Arlington Heights, here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I think after clearing away all the legalistic minutiae and the other cobwebs and all this stuff, the ultimate issue here is whether the presidency is, is he or she someone who can actually represent the people of the United States? Or is it just an avatar of the mood of the people that can then be tied down like Gulliver by all the Lilliputians, by the bureaucrats? That's really the question here. That's what Andrew Jackson's presidency was about when he wanted to go against all the corruption in the Monroe administration and just the bureaucracy that you had back then in the early 1800s. Very similar. And Andrew Jackson fought all that with his bank war and various other different things. Trump, you know, he had Andrew Jackson's picture in the Oval Office. That's what I think he was trying to do, was give the presidency back to the people, rather than just have it be some
something
that is controlled by them.
Yeah, but
and one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
And one more thing is on this whole thing about standing. Whenever I hear these idiots talk about whether this person has standing or not, you know who didn't have standing? Dred Scott. Lack of standing is just a matter for the courts to sit there and be pusillanimous and not really defend the Constitution. Oh, you don't have standing. Just go defend the Constitution and do your job, is my opinion.
Well, okay. I mean, I disagree with you about that. I mean, not in the case of Dred Scott, but yes, I mean, the law is fallible because it's made by fallible men, as you know. The thing about the Andrew Jackson comparison, I mean, it's a reminder, and what we're experiencing today, to me, it's a reminder that politics is a contest in aligning interests. It's not making friends. It's aligning interests. And this is something that too few people understand, it seems. But the difference here is all the lines have been erased. So the aligning and advancing interests are the law is subject to the aligning and advancing of interests rather than the reverse. And that's a different thing than we've seen in this country really ever. I think we're so much further down the road of your politics determining the application of the law for you or against you. That to me is the real, you know, to borrow a phrase the left is parroting on every, you know, on the 15s every hour. That, to me, is the real threat to democracy, or our representative republic, more accurately.
Well, we live in an oligarchy, no doubt, and whether we can get our republic back is really an open question. It really is. So,
thanks, Frank.
Have a good day.
John, Naperville.
Yeah, you know, you look at that Bob Alinsky story and the mass media and that throttling down the stories or not putting the stories out there about Hunter Biden. How could anybody say the election was not rigged? I mean, the election was only, you know, a couple of maybe 40, 50,000 votes. That could have easily swayed 40, 50,000 votes.
Thanks for the call, John. Well, and you know, Zuckerberg's appearance on Rogan the other week and the whole the FBI came and visited him and told him, you know, be wary of this stuff. We're not telling you what to do. We can't tell you what to do. We just want to give you the heads up.
And they linked it to Russian collusion.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the wink and the nod. We're not telling you what to do. We just thought we'd stop by and give you a friendly tip. And now you know that you have people within the FBI that more likely than not were running interference on an investigation into the Biden family. You know, when the issue couldn't be more salient a few weeks before a national election. Right. Yes. I mean, this is where stolen, you say stolen, I say rigged. You say rule of law, I say the rule of politics.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know, it's sad when you see somebody who's bright and reasonable, stays in his lane, go into government, and lose about 60 IQ points and become one of these sort of ghastly automatons for the prevailing talking points of the day. That's what's happened to Dr. Ashish Jha.
I know, I used to love him.
Dr. Ashish Jha, he's the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. He's on leave. He's also on leave from his senses at a little confab Zoom operation yesterday.
You know, we're
talking about the rollout of Bivalent and the annual jab you get for COVID. Now that's what the protocol is going to be, or that's what they're advocating. Here's what he said.
The good news is you can get both your flu shot and COVID shot at the same time. It's actually a good idea. I really believe this is why God gave us two arms, one for the flu shot and the other one for the COVID shot.
You know, I know he's just being glib. I get that.
Oh,
I know he's being glib.
Wow.
But, you know, after the last 2.5 years, it's just not a good look to be glib about this stuff. You're not a comedian. Don't be one. Just make the case for Bivalent or whatever it is you're advocating. It's so tone deaf to me, you know. But anyway, the larger issue is this new protocol where stop getting jabs every 5 seconds and just do it once a year.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, they were on a local level and a national level. Yesterday was the meet the new booster. And if you don't get it, you could die. Dan, this is the fifth shot now. The Bivalent is the newest one to fight the Omicron variants.
Uh-huh.
And I learned yesterday that if you don't get the shot, not only could you die, you might kill
Grandma.
How'd you know?
Yeah.
Getting vaccinated right now with this updated vaccine is not just about me and my protection. It's about making it harder for new variants to emerge. And so the reason we're emphasizing this so much is that we can't completely control what happens in flu in the winter season. I do think we'll see probably some issues with COVID, but the more people who can get protected right now against the strain that's here right now will, I believe, help limit that surge.
And she put out a graph and said, if you do, you know, if you you're six times more likely to die if you get COVID if you're not vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
have we convinced you yet?
I love the idea that it's being presented as just like the flu shot, because now I can treat the COVID shot just like I do the annual flu shot, which is to get neither.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. They'll come to your house. They'll give you $50. They're begging people to take this. We have 150,000 doses here in Chicago. And, you know, it's like no one wants to take it. And do you want to know why no one wants to take it, Dan?
Because they're too focused on monkeypox?
No, because they're over it. Because they've gotten, some people that I know have gotten four shots have had COVID three times. They're not working. And also, you know,
we went back and forth.
She said they did people trials.
It's almost like what Dr. Robert Malone argued. And I'm not saying this is what it is, but he argued that, you have vaccines would cause this immunity attenuation where you would actually be more susceptible to the virus. I don't know. I mean, it is rather curious that the vaccinated are outnumbering the unvaccinated in terms of infection.
Yeah, and they did no human trials on this. They tried this out on eight mice.
Oh, wow.
Eight mice. And this is the thing, too. But in
Speaking of blind mice, see how they run.
In Chicago, there's still a vaccine mandate in place for Chicago firefighters, police officers, school teachers.
So the vaccine mandate that's in place for Chicago firefighters and police officers, how does this booster fit in with that?
It doesn't change anything. Our policy is still the same. Obviously, we're about, I think, 89% of our city employees who are vaccinated. So we just encourage those who have already gotten and completed their series to complete their series.
Yeah, just step up.
What about mandating the monkeypox vaccine? Is that going to be part of the series?
No, that's not going to be part of the series.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, of course. I mean, of course we are. Of course the mandates are in place because we're still in a state of a public health emergency here for the 33rd straight month. Don't forget. So why wouldn't the mandates be in place?
When we need police officers the most right now on the street, there's still dozens of police officers who refuse to get vaccinated. They dropped the weekly testing, so that's good. But they also refuse to get a religious exemption or a medical exemption because they just don't want to take it. You know, my body, my choice, whatever happened to that when it comes to the vaccine?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. Back to Dr. Jha, who I used to respect because he was one of the first people to come on television and say, you know what, these states that aren't allowing kids back in school need to let kids back in school. Well, yesterday he said, well, we need... You know, are things ever going to get back to normal?
I've heard Secretary Cardona say this over and over again. You know, people do talk about going back to normal. And I've heard Mr. Secretary say, you know, normal wasn't working out so well for some people. And so the goal in my mind is not to go back to normal. The goal is to build a very different new normal that has equity much more at the heart of it.
Hmm. Yeah. See, this is a good example of what I was referring to before. Back in the day when he was just the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, he would make sense. He wouldn't be offering these left-wing platitudes. He wouldn't be glib. He would stay in his lane. Now he's a member of the Borg in good standing, and you get what you're getting from him. Oh, it wasn't great. Yeah, no, I know it wasn't great before. I know it was school choice advocates, and which is driven by conservatives, by the way, free market types, that have been advocating, oh, I don't know, since Milton Friedman talked about it in Capitalism and Freedom 70 years ago, a rethinking of how we do K-12 education in this country. It wasn't Dr. Jha, and it wasn't his friends in the Biden administration and the teachers' unions, that's for sure. We want to go back to a new paradigm with equity as its core. Okay, well, that's super wonderful, Doc. But here's where we're at because of the choices that the people you're now flacking for made. In 2020, the United States' loss of life expectancy was more than three times the average of other advanced nations. We lost about 3.1 years for men and 2.3 years for women. In 2021, while most of our peers regained some lost ground, the United States continued moving in the wrong direction. The life expectancy gap between the U.S. and peer nations expanded by nearly 2 years. Public education, we mentioned this yesterday. We'll mention it again.
Yeah. Don't ever forget it.
The NAEP, National Assessment of Education Progress, showed a historic drop in achievement among fourth graders. Between 2020 and 2022, reading and math scores fell by 5 and 7 points, respectively, to lows not seen in decades. And as Dr. Jha intimates, you're starting with not great proficiency to begin with in much of the country. In math achievement, black students lost 13 points and Hispanic students 8 points, compared with 6 points for Asians and 5 for whites. Differences even more stark between high and low achieving individuals. At the top, NAEP reading scores and math fell by an average of 2 to 3 points. At the bottom, by 10 to 12. So when you're talking equity, Doc, just understand these COVIDian lockdown policies and school shutdown policies and remote learning, they hammered the least able to take the hammering the most. That's what they did. So continue to prattle on about equity. It's funny because even Bill Galston, writing in the Wall Street Journal, who's left, you know, he's, you know, we need to take stock of and own up to America's pandemic failures. And we should support this bipartisan commission that Bob Menendez and Susan Collins want to do to look into what happened during the pandemic and what we can do better next time and so on and so forth, which is about as close as you're going to get to an admission of guilt, to a recognition of failure, to an understanding that the trade-offs we made were the wrong trade-offs. And the left, it galls me to no end, the left can get away with moralizing about equity when, again, the least able to take the policies that were advanced got hammered the most. Hammered the most. You sent kids that were behind much further behind. Of course you did. Of course those on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, those relegated to neighborhood schools that haven't educated anybody except accidentally for 5 generations, of course they got hammered the most. Anybody could see that coming. We did. But then they still get to run around. Now we need to rethink it. Forget what we were doing before pandemic. We need to do better. Yay. Oh, wow. Wonderful optimism. Real moonshot type rhetoric. Bull jive. You're a hack. You know what you were doing before the pandemic, which is the wealthy and the well-connected that get to send their kids to good schools. And if it's up to you guys and your teachers' union underwriters, the poor middle income to poor families don't. And now it's worse. Now you're playing catch up with grade schoolers who are a year or two or more behind in reading and math proficiency in school districts that don't do a great job producing kids into high school and beyond that are particularly competent when it comes to reading and math to begin with. Equity at the heart of it. Now, the flip side is Florida. Ron DeSantis is up with a new ad owning.
I cried when I saw this.
Owning the policies that he chose and that Florida Republicans chose when those trade-offs were presented to them.
Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Ron DeSantis.
Today we deliver for the people of Florida yet again.
You saved our jobs.
And kept us going.
They tried to shut us down, but you saved our business.
$1,000 bonuses.
You had our backs.
And honored our service.
You led by facts, not fear.
And you let us decide.
You let me go to school.
You gave me a voice.
You put us first.
And didn't let them keep us apart.
You let us learn.
You let us compete.
All of us.
You protected our right to worship together in person.
And you raised our pay.
You protected our waters
and kept Florida beautiful.
When they attacked you, you didn't cave.
You stood strong for Florida.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Governor.
Gracias, Gobernador DeSantis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Governor DeSantis.
And the part that brought tears to my eyes when she said, you didn't let them keep us apart, was a girl with her grandpa, because he let people see loved ones who were dying, where you couldn't do that here. And there is story after story of people who their grandma was dying, or their mom or their dad was dying, and they could not go into the nursing home or the, you know, long-term care facility to say goodbye to them. They had to do it through a window. Please. It was barbaric.
Thank you, Governor Santis, and damn you, Governor Pritzker.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was a fun exchange yesterday between Fox News' Peter Doocy and...
Hey, JP.
Karine Jean-Pierre, the quadruple threat. So this business of protesting election results, it's a real problem. It's a threat to our democracy. Well, so then why'd you do it, KJP?
I'm trying to understand the new attention on the MAGA Republicans. You tweeted in 2016,
I knew this
Trump
was coming.
Stole an election.
I was waiting, Peter, when you were going to ask me that question.
Well, here we go. You tweeted Trump stole an election. You tweeted Brian Kemp stole an election. If denying election results is extreme now, why would
So let's be really clear. That comparison that you made is just ridiculous. You're asking me a question. Yes. Let me answer it.
And you said it was ridiculous.
I was talking specifically at that time of what was happening with voting rights and the what was in danger of voting rights.
No, you weren't.
That's what I was speaking to at the time.
No, you weren't.
And here's the thing. I have said Governor Kemp won the election in Georgia. I've been clear about that. I have said President Trump won the election of 2016, and I've been clear about that. What we are talking about right now is, let's not forget what happened on January 6, 2021, when we saw an insurrection, a mob that was incited by the person who occupied this campus, this facility.
Who occupied the campus and facilities, that's called the president. It doesn't sound like you're clear that President Trump won the election. By the way, when you say it was stolen and then you say, no, he won, that's being anything but clear. So which is it? I was talking about it in the context of voting rights. You just said they stole it straight up, both Trump as well as Kemp in Georgia. And this is what they do. This is how disingenuous they are. We played this before, but just to snippet again, we've got 10 minutes. It's a great mashup montage that somebody put together. 10 minutes of Democrat Paul's, all the leading lights of the left, accusing President Trump of stealing an election before they accused George W. Bush of stealing an election in 2000. Every time they lose, the election was stolen. Every single time.
You can run the best campaign. You can even become the nominee. And you can have the election stolen from you.
How can you win with Russian interference, though?
That's the real thing.
That's what I'm scared about in 2020.
But rightly.
Because I think he's an illegitimate president that didn't really win. So how do you, you know, fight against that in 2020?
You are absolutely right.
Absolutely right.
He's an illegitimate president in my mind.
Would you be my vice presidential candidate? Folks, look, I absolutely agree.
Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He lost the election. And he was put in office because the Russians interfered.
Trump. Jimmy Carter. Joe Biden.
On.
Kamala Harris. Hillary Clinton. We could go on and on and on. And here's the point. The point is not just the hypocrisy of the left. There's an underlying point. And we mentioned some of his remarks in response to Joe Biden's Darth Sidious speech last week, Thursday night. Responding to who's undermining democracy. And of course, it's the authoritarian left. Michigan State political philosophy professor William Allen had something else to say that we didn't get to yesterday about this idea of protesting election results. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Moreover, it is radically unfair to describe the most recent protests of electoral outcome as not normal. But nothing has been more normal in the politics of the U.S. than for elections to be not only contested as unfair, but sometimes actually marred by fraud. Recent memory of Stacey Abrams, Hillary Clinton, and hashtag resistance suffice the ordinary intelligence to understand that. But we can scan over 200 years of experience to demonstrate just how normal it is. And we will never forget that the tragedy of 1860-1865 originated in the refusal to acknowledge an electoral defeat as legitimate. Thus, false history also plays a role in mounting a Jeremiad from the presidential pulpit, the real purpose of which is not to unite but to divide the country for paltry political purposes. I get it. The president doesn't want to lose. Therefore, he's willing to do or say anything that he imagines calculated to avoid that prospect. In doing so, however, he endangers our free, self-governing politics by sacrificing its real integrity and substance for a mock display of virtue.
Mm. The questioning of elections, the questioning of anything, is profoundly American. Everything should be questioned. Nobody, no institution, no thing should be beyond reproach. Now, does the form of the inquiry of the protest matter? Of course it does. Should never descend into violence. But the idea that it doesn't bother me that Hillary Clinton and every other Democrat ran around in 2016 saying Trump colluded with the Russians to steal an election. It bothered me that they manipulated institutions and undermined the credibility of those institutions. Those institutions allow themselves to be manipulated, allow their credibility to be undermined. Because now we can't trust them anymore. And we're worse off because of it. Less safe in particular. But it doesn't bother me. You want to make an argument? Great, I'll make an argument right back. No problem. I'm not trying to silence anybody. Come up with whatever crackpot conspiracy theory you want. I'm not afraid of it. It's not jeopardizing our democracy. Suppressing your right to a particular point of view, no matter how half-baked, that's what undermines a free society. Mm-hmm. And that's the left. So they're not only hypocrites, when they land on a target you like, if you're center-left, they act in a way that undermines the democracy they suggest they're attempting to save. More than hypocrisy. They got it all wrong. Which is why we need to rally the faithful for November 8th. And here in Illinois, our friend Tom Meredith, who was, as I mentioned before, Mike Scott's news, an organizer of all those massive Trump rallies that you saw in Kane County and Woodstock and elsewhere during the 2020 cycle. He's got another one coming up this Sunday on the anniversary of 9/11. You've heard of MAGA. This is MIG, Make Illinois Great. MIG rally, Kane County Republicans parade and rally starting at 11 a.m. at the Kane County Fairgrounds. It'll run, that's the parade, the rally itself with speakers including Steve Moore, who we have on the show this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Get a preview of his remarks. Steve Moore will be there. Gary Rabine, Republican nominee for governor, Darren Bailey, Republican nominee for attorney general, Tom DeVore, Republican nominee for state Supreme Court, Mark Curran, and many others. For more on this event, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Tom Meredith. Tom, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dan and Amy.
So you haven't given up hope in Illinois. You're still trying to rally the faithful here with about 7 weeks to go.
We are. I think in my lifetime, this is probably our best chance of really making a difference in Illinois. You know, and I don't know anyone who likes Pritzker, even the Democrats. So hopefully we can turn it here.
Well, how did you get the word out about this, and how many people are you expecting at the event?
You know, the greatest one that we had was the September 2021 for Trump at King County Fairgrounds, where we did have over 10,000 people. our parade lasted for over 4 hours of just straight vehicles driving down Roosevelt Road through Geneva and stuff. You know, that's the funny thing about this. We never know how many are going to show. When I first started these in April of 2020, you know, it just started out with a few hundred cars, and then it grew to 10,000 people. So you can never can tell, but hopefully people are ready to go out and do something about it.
And, I mean, since it is on 9/11, I should hasten to add that there will be a tribute to 9/11 first responders, police and fire, paramedics, as part of that.
We have a great, great, great presentation and stuff with a flag ceremony. 403 flags will be put on the fairgrounds there. It's going to be a great show. It's free. Everyone's come on in if you can't make the parade. The parade starts in West Chicago in the industrial section on Charles Court. There's empty streets out there on Sunday. And we're going to line up the vehicles there, drive down Roosevelt Road. The parade leaves at 11:30 a.m. and goes straight down Roosevelt to the fairgrounds.
And there's food and festivities there, or what do you have in addition to the speakers at the rally?
So yeah, there's going to be food vendors. Actually, there's going to be a dunk tank there, and I'm sure you can imagine whose mask is going to be worn in the dunk tank.
Is Dan Prof going to be the dunk tank?
No,
he doesn't do that.
No. I don't do.
You don't do parades.
I have stuntmen for that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Last time I knocked the dunk tank, got the girl in the dunk tank. But so in the past, it feels like Biden's been in office for 10 years. What has upset you most about his time in office?
What hasn't? I think everything is equal. Each week, he seems to try to get away with more and more and more. You know, when this first started, his presidency, you know, everyone was saying, oh, there's no way he can do that. There's no way he can do that. And a year and a half, almost 2 years later, he's done everything that we said he couldn't do. And it's done and getting worse.
And so when you talk, since you're sort of ear to the ground here with the people, per the number of people who've turned out for your rallies over the years, what do you sense is what rankles them the most? What they feel about Illinois, what issue is animating them as they're thinking about their choices on November 8th?
You know, I think it's their pocketbooks mostly, you know. Mm-hmm. And if we can get the suburban housewives to realize what's happening to the children, that's why we brought Yako in. He's a great speaker and stuff. Illinois is the number one state for human trafficking, which I didn't realize that, but it's... And Yako is such a great speaker. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Yako Boyens, who's a expert in human trafficking and is a filmmaker, he's one of your speakers as well.
Yeah, he's outstanding. You know, so if we can get the suburban housewives in front of one of his speeches and stuff, I think that will change their tune of the way that they feel about what's going on in Illinois.
Why are we number one in that disgusting area?
Because of the sanctuary city and stuff.
And mm-hmm. Maybe parental notification as well, too. So if somebody gets pregnant, you don't need notification. You can just go get an abortion.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons, yeah.
And
we're going to learn all about him on September 11th, that's for sure.
All right. And so Steve Moore, Darren Bailey, what do you think the you got Gary Rabin, who ran for governor in the Republican primary. What do you think the energy is for Republicans here locally right now? Are you encouraged by what you're seeing in terms of the possibility of Republicans actually making gains this year in Illinois?
You know, I feel as if the Republican Party obviously is very weak in Illinois. But if we can rally, you know, 10 neighbors and, you know, and build strength by numbers and stuff, and then really start to let them say, I mean, they're afraid of, I couldn't tell you how many politicians wouldn't come to my rallies, Republicans wouldn't come to my rallies because it was Trump. They didn't want to be seen with a Trump sign backing them. I mean, they have to come to the realization that that the people here of Illinois are mostly Trump people, you know, They're mega people. Okay.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and it's funny too because the flip side. I remember the rally I came to at Woodstock at Bull Valley, where I spoke. I mean, Todd Ricketts, who was then the RNC finance chairman, he was there. So you mean we've got, you know, Todd Ricketts, member of the Ricketts family owns the Cubs. I mean, he wasn't afraid to, you know, speak to the moment and the need to reelect President Trump. And yet so many Republican office holders in Illinois are, and it speaks to, well, it speaks to their super minority status. If you're unwilling to make an argument, if you are ashamed or afraid of who you are and to whom you affiliate, then that's not going to be very persuasive, it turns out.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. You hate your country that much that just because you don't like someone's personality, you're going to vote against them no matter what it happens to your children, your pocketbook. It's really absurd.
And now President Biden said, you know, MAGA Republicans, anybody who voted for Trump is a threat against the United States or a threat to the United States. I'm sure they're going to be addressing that this
starting weekend. With Steve Moore. He's yeah. Public enemy number one.
Yeah. I think we all got a bullseye on our back, right?
Well, that's good. So, you know, come together to create one big bullseye. All of you insurrectionists and deplorables and credulous boomer rubes and all the other names you've been called for so much. Join Tom Meredith this coming Sunday, September 11th. King County Fairgrounds, that's 1 to 4. The parade that starts at 11 that goes to King County Fairgrounds. Tell me again where that starts, Tom, with the cars lining up.
Sure. Charles Court in West Chicago. It's in the industrial area right off of Washington and Roosevelt Roads.
All right. So West Chicago to the King County Fairgrounds, where you guys will rally for a few hours, tribute to 9/11 first responders. You'll hear from Steve Moore. You'll hear from Darren Bailey. You'll hear from Gary Rabine. You'll hear from Yacob Boyens about human trafficking, as we were discussing, and many more, including other candidates on the ballot on November 8th. Tom Meredith, is there a website if people want more information on the rally or just what we gave you?
They can go to the Kane County Republican website.
Okay.
And there's some information on that also.
Okay, check it out. Kane County Republicans, again, September 11th, this Sunday. Parade starts in West Chicago at 11, as you heard. Rally starts at the Kane County Fairgrounds at 1 o'clock. Tom, thanks for joining us, as always. Good luck on Sunday.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and in our continuing effort to bring you the candidates on the ballot on September 8th, started yesterday, coming out of Labor Day. We'll be doing it for the next 8-9 weeks, 7-9 weeks.
Yeah. 60 days, 59 days now.
Yeah, 8 weeks.
You do the math, thank you.
Yeah, roughly.
Glad you're here.
We're pleased to be rejoined. We talked to him during the primary along with his opponents. Now we talk to him as the Republican nominee for Attorney General in the state of Illinois. He is Tom DeVore. Get more information on his campaign, Tom DeVore, DeVore, TomDeVore.com. Tom, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan.
Well, I guess we start with the issue upon which you rose to some prominence in this state, and that is COVID-related lockdowns, shutdowns, mandates. We're in month 33 of a public emergency as we stand here today.
According to Governor Pritzker, yeah, we're still in the, almost 3 years of a COVID pandemic.
Well, why do you think that is? Because my theory is that if it ends, then teachers throughout the whole state of Illinois, if they get COVID, they don't have to count those as sick days if they're not in school.
I think that's one issue, Amy. I think the bigger issue has to do with federal funding. I believe the governor continues to declare COVID a disaster in Illinois because the federal government still has a COVID disaster in place. And as long as that continues, Governor Pritzker continues to receive federal funding that he can use to bolster the financial health of our state. So that's typically what disaster declarations have always been about traditionally, is federal financial aid. And so I think that's where the governor's at with that right now.
Well, probably so. Yeah, probably so. But we have the bigger matter is the rule of law. And we have a very curious interpretation of his executive authority that he can just issue 30-day emergency orders in perpetuity till rapture. That seems to me an improper interpretation of the law. And so if you were attorney general, if you agree that it's an improper interpretation, is there something you could do about it?
Yeah, two things we can do. One, which would be, depending upon the results of our election, a tall order to try to get the legislature to clean that language up. If that's not an option, then that's why the Supreme Court race has become extremely important race, because that issue needs to be taken to the Supreme Court. We have an appellate court decision called the Foxfire matter, where, with all due respect to those justices, I think they made a horrible decision suggesting that that language could be interpreted in the Emergency Management Agency Act, that the governor can issue these serial disaster proclamations. It's an absolute ruse, Dan. It's a twisted pretzel version of that language that the governor's been getting away with because the legislature's let him, and is to date one appellate court. I think if that went back to a different appellate court today, 3 years later, that they may have a different look on that. But the courts or the legislature need to clean that up for certain, one way or another. And if I'm the attorney general, I would do everything I could to make that happen.
What do you think the impact was? Do you see a lasting impact, particularly now as a candidate on the campaign trail, from the case you took up on behalf of parents and teachers and kids around the state against the school shutdowns?
I think the lasting impact of that is one of the things that I've always tried to encourage people to do, is to stand up for themselves. I mean, as much as the law had to do with that case, Dan, it had to do with people defending their liberties and freedoms, because I've told people all along that ultimately branches of government don't defend your liberty and freedom. You defend them on behalf of yourself and your family. And so the message for me on that issue was that people being involved is the most important part. I mean, Judge Grisho, when she issued that ruling in February of 2022, she issued a ruling that was contradictory to the ruling that she issued 16 months prior on the same issue in August of 2020. The law didn't change. Nothing changed other than people. And when people change in the way that they manage their affairs with government, it has a significant impact. And I hope that that's something that people have learned over the last few years and through that case specifically.
Now, your opponent, obviously incumbent Kwame Raoul, has he accomplished anything while he's been the Attorney General of Illinois?
Well, he's accomplished doing what the governor wants him to do. I mean, with all the respect that I can give to my esteemed colleague, he's in the position in his career, the attorney general, to where he can't be independent. His financial livelihood, his success as a politician hinges upon him appeasing the system that got him to where he's at. He didn't get there by his own deeds and doing right by people. He got there by pandering to a political machine that he's now emboldened to. So my answer to you is no, he's not done anything other than what he's been told to do. And, you know, we don't have a lot of time, but public corruption is a prime example of that. He's not prosecuted one person for public corruption in the 8 years that he's been there, notwithstanding there's numerous examples of which he could have done that, most recently the Thornley work comp fraud that the governor's complicit in.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that case, but I just, since you mentioned the Grishow order on the mask mandates that impacted 145 school districts, I just want to remind people what that Sangamon County judge, Raylene Grishow, said in her opinion on the matter. She said, I'm quoting, "Statutory rights have attempted to be bypassed through the issuance of executive orders and emergency rules. This type of evil is exactly what the law was intended to constrain." She's saying, essentially, that we have one-person rule in this state, and the suspension of the rule of law, which, you know, statutory laws are intended to prevent, respecting the three branches of government and the lawmaking process and the distribution of powers. And that was set aside, has been set aside for much of the last 3 years. And that to me is just so fundamental that it seems to me, particularly as the person running for chief law enforcement officer of the state, that, you know, if we don't have the rule of law, then we don't have anything. We see this in a public safety sense, but also in a due process sense. If we don't have due process, then nobody's rights are safe.
It's the only thing, Dan, that distinguishes us between where we came from as a nation and where we might go. It's really one of the only reasons I'm running for this office, because what you just read from her order right there is everything that makes this country different than others that have come before us. It's the only thing. And she was exactly right. It was set aside. It was orchestrated around what she's referring to, some activity by the governor and administrative agencies in September of 2021 is what she's referring to there specifically. But there was a concerted effort by the governor and these administrative agencies to work around due process, try to exclude the courts from oversight of these types of matters. It was horrific, and it doesn't get talked about enough, but that's exactly why I'm running for this. The rule of law always controls. We don't like the law, we change the law through the legislature. But to let executive officers, any executive officer, I don't care what party you're from, Democrat, Republican, to work around it as a quick fix solution to allegedly keep people safe, if that's how we're going to govern moving forward in this state, in this nation, we are going to lose this republic. It's all I care about. And the laws that we pass are the laws that we pass. I'll accept them if I don't like them. But we have to govern that way.
Another example of this, recently this ordinance passed by the Naperville City Council to ban some sport rifles that the majority of that board find frightening. They don't have the authority to do that under state law. So that's my reading, and a lot of other people's too. And so my question, is that something else where you as Attorney General intervene and remind Naperville what the limits of their power are?
Absolutely. I mean, that has to, and Dan, I'm glad you bring that up, because that example that you just, you know, we like to talk about Governor Pritzker's abuses of authority that he's engaged in, and it's really brought these issues to the surface. But when you get down to city council levels, to mayor levels, and to other lower branches of government, these abuses of authority that they've been delegated, it happens on an exhaustive basis statewide and nation probably, but in our state we're talking about, it happens every day. And I talk to people that spend nothing but pretty much all their time fighting these issues, and it needs to be addressed, and our attorney general has an obligation at all levels of government to make sure that these elected officials stay within the confines of their delegated authority by the people. And it's probably one of the most important jobs that the attorney general has, and the current one that we have and the one before and going back, they've not done it because they're more concerned about politics than they are actually making sure the rule of law is followed.
And I know you're a busy man and you've helped hundreds of parents throughout the state of Illinois, and they're very appreciative. But has anybody reached out to you to try to end this 5-day quarantine if you have a cold, otherwise known as COVID? I mean, they're locking you out of government schools. You're perfectly healthy. Where are we on that? Are we ever going to go back to normal?
You know, the CDC guidance that you're talking about, mm-hmm. and the IDPH and ISBE have kind of adopted, I have my air quotes going. It's funny that when we had a hearing here, and it's probably been a month ago now, Amy, the governor's office, and I heard that the assistant attorney general, this young man that said this, got scolded directly by Kwame Raoul. He finally admitted on the record in the courtroom that guidance is just that. It's something you can choose to follow or not to follow. And I kind of looked at him when he was saying that, chuckling, and I was on camera, and you could see my expression, going, I don't know if the governor would agree with you, because he's been enforcing guidance down people's throats for years. But this issue that you're talking about, it's a little bit different where it's predicated on a positive test, this five-day thing you're talking about. So, you know, it's not as blanket and as lawless as it was before, but there's still an issue of due process that's involved in that new guidance that school districts, there's only about three school districts in the state that are doing what you're talking about.
Really?
The other 840-something are just absolutely doing none of this stuff. They're not even talking about it. But the few that are doing it, it's still a conversation that we're having of how that might be addressed.
I want to go back to public corruption. And you mentioned the Thornley case, which we've talked about on this show. You know, it's actually not that complicated. It raises questions that we don't have answers to, and maybe you can get some of those answers. But it seems to me, you know, you try to illustrate public corruption. I'm going to go after corrupt public officials. That's an abstraction. The Jennifer Thornley case is something that's concrete. This Illinois State Police Merit Board employee who is alleged to have committed all sorts of criminal acts and time and again invoked both the governor's name, JB, as well as his wife's name, MK, as sort of her clout. And the suggestion was that when she started to get in trouble, they intervened on her behalf. And we don't know, at least I don't know, why that would be. Why, especially now that she's under indictment, why the governor and his wife would intervene on her behalf again and again against law enforcement personnel like Jack Garcia, who was the ED at the time of the Illinois State Police Merit Board. It's just a very curious case. And we don't have an answer to me to that fundamental question. Why'd they get involved in something that was not their business, really?
You know, that's a fair question, Dan. But I think the issue of work, because she was indicted for overtime fraud, where she was turning in overtime
right.
hours that she had, in fact, not worked. And that's documented with video, et cetera. But the issue of the work comp fraud is conclusive, because what happened is once she knew she was had on the overtime fraud, she concocted a alleged sexual assault against her boss. And she filed a notice of injury with TriStar, which is the third-party insurance administrator for the state of Illinois. And in that, and she alleged emotional trauma from this now-debunked sexual assault.
Right.
She listed the governor's office, Dan, as her employer and J.B. Pritzker as her direct supervisor in that application, which is a patently false application to receive workman's comp benefits, which under the law is felony. She filed that notice and then eventually started collecting almost $70,000 of benefits after she was fired for stealing from the taxpayers, because there was a $550,000 investigation from the governor's recommended investigator.
Yeah, McGuire Woods did an investigation and cleared Garcia of the sexual harassment charges.
Right, but he can't get his reputation
Correct.
Back.
Yeah, and
Correct.
He's now got a different job. But so everything she did was wrong, and she's always pointing to the governor, and it seemed like the governor had her back, maybe continues to.
He did, and the Department of Insurance, the fraud unit of the Department of Insurance says, and it's in the emails, that this is a clear case of workman's compensation fraud. The clear case. And says we will, in fact, refer this for prosecution if it's going to be prosecuted. It's in the emails, man. And so the question was, why wouldn't it be prosecuted? Kwame Raoul has been on the camera
right.
twice being asked by Greg Bishop, why aren't you prosecuting? Kwame concocts a conflict. There is no conflict whatsoever. But if there was a conflict, Kwame would then file a motion with the court saying, please appoint the appellate prosecutor to take this case against these specific identifiable people because I have a conflict. Kwame has never done that. There was actually an email when he got on camera and said that. There was an email immediately from Robinson of the AG or appellate prosecutor's office to the AG saying, we don't know what you're talking about. This just happened last month. We don't know what you're talking about. We've never been appointed to this case. If you want us appointed to this case, you got to ask the court.
Right.
But we don't know why we would be taking this case. This is your case. Kwame doubled down on that. And the reason he won't file the motion, Dan, is because he has to actually allege and convince the judge that there's a conflict. And there's not one and he would have to list who he's going to prosecute, which would not just be Jenny Thornley, because we have emails that Ann Spillane herself, general counsel for the governor's office, materially participated in getting her those $70,000 of work comp benefits. Leave the sexual assault that's been debunked out of it, Dan. The application itself is patently fraudulent because it lists the employer being the governor who she never worked for.
And you know who Ann Spillane used to be?
Who?
Lisa Madigan's chief of staff.
Oh, yes. Wow.
I mean,
So
you're right to raise Kwame Rowland what he's not doing. But I assume that all roads lead back to Pritzker, and that goes back to your point about Kwame Rowland can't be his own man because he's beholden to the governor. So he's the governor's attorney. He's not the people's attorney. And this is a problem. But boy, if only we had an enterprising press that would ask these uncomfortable questions of exactly why this mid-level person at the Illinois State Police Merit Board merits so much attention and has so much protection from on high. It's very curious.
Yeah. And then the governor gets on television and says, I don't know anything other than I've seen in the newspapers, notwithstanding there's emails to Mrs. Pritzker that she wanted to make sure JB knew.
Right. Right.
And there's cell phone calls.
If you have a break in that case, do let us know. One more thing before we let you go, just on the top. Corruption. So on the issue of crime, the Attorney General State Attorney General is not situated similar to U.S. Attorney. But we're seeing, for example, in Minneapolis, which is becoming Murderapolis again, like it was in the 90s, the U.S. Attorney there working with state and local to provide some federal support to pull people who are violent criminals out for federal prosecution and bye-bye time. And we don't see anything like that here. I assume it's not because John Lausch is unwilling. Probably has something to do with prosecutor in Cook County, mayor, and so forth. What about the attorney general? Is there a role you see with respect to violent crime that a state AG can play?
Absolutely there is. You know, they don't do it much. Kwame doesn't, and I think I know why. You can revert back to the conversation we just had before. But the Attorney General's office has concurrent jurisdiction over these types of matters. And the Attorney General can absolutely go into these counties and prosecute criminals that these state attorney generals won't prosecute. The law is clear. So, you know, if I'm the Attorney General and there is someone like Kim Fox who is clearly abdicating her duties, and it's causing these types of issues, I will be going in there with prosecutors myself, and we'll be prosecuting these criminals, because you just said what's going on out there is the same thing that's going on in Cook County. I mean, you and I see the videos every day of these emboldened criminals, and we've actually, you know, talked to people that in those communities, of Maori communities, where the criminals are saying, well, we were not going to get in trouble because Kim Fox won't prosecute us. So the Attorney General's office can do it, and it's my administration, we will.
He is Tom DeVore. He's the Republican nominee for Illinois Attorney General. For more info on his campaign, get involved. Tom DeVore, DEVORE, TomDeVore.com. Tom, thanks as always.
Thank you, Dan. Take care. See you, Amy.
Bye. Thanks so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Is it going to be a chilly winter in Western Europe as the Russians slow walk the provision of energy through pipelines? Well, that was put to White House spokesman KJP, Karine Jean-Pierre. And, you know, this is what she had to say, her geopolitical analysis. She's bright, you know.
So you've heard us say this, that what we see Russia's doing, and we've been very clear about this, is that they're using energy, they're weaponizing energy, and it's choosing to one of the things that has been out there, to shut down the pipeline of Nord Stream 1.
Nord Stream pipeline? I thought it was just Nord Stream 1. If they shut down the Nord Stream pipeline, then you know what happens next. They're going to shut down the Neiman Marcus pipeline. And then Europe's really in a pickle. For more on energy policy, Steve Moore, MAG extremist, economist, Trumponomics, and Godzilla author.
He's a threat to the U.S.
Yeah. Steve, what have you heard about the Bloomingdale's pipeline? Is that safe, or are the Ruskies going after that, too?
What about Macy's?
You guys are mean.
Oh.
No. KJP is just dumb, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah, look, I love this fact that, the Europeans, the Russians won't keep their pipelines, in operation, and we won't build them here in the United States. I mean, it's absurd.
Who could have predicted the Ruskies would turn off the power after Europe folded in and sanctioned them? Boy, who could have predicted that generated response?
Well, I'll tell you who could have predicted that. Donald Trump did. He was the one who told the Europeans, remember? He said, don't get hooked on this Russian oil and gas. And, of course, they laughed at him, and now they're paying a high price. But do you know what gas costs now in London?
What?
$11 a gallon.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Wonderful.
Well, it's so bad there in the U.K. that teachers are in food bank lines.
So I was in I've been chopping at the bit to talk to you guys because I was in the great state of California, the late great state of California this past weekend. And it was, you all probably know the story, but being there when it all happened. So, the first day I'm there, their great governor, Gavin Newsom, who's the leading Democratic, the predictors are saying he's going to be the Democrat savior in 2024 because he's been such a great governor. He announced that every car bought and sold in the state of California after the year 2035 has to be a electric vehicle. No more traditional cars. You got to get an electric vehicle. Then 2 days later, they have a heat wave, and he announces everybody has to stop charging electric cars.
Right.
We from 4 to 9 p.m.
electric power. And that people, and by the way, right now, only 5% of the cars in California are electric vehicles. So imagine what it's going to be like when 100% are. So, this green energy thing is blowing up all over the world. It is causing an incredible crisis. And what's so frustrating to me, Dan and Amy, is, look, Europe has tried the green energy stuff. They went all in on solar, wind power. They're about 5 to 10 years ahead of us. It is a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe. It's deindustrializing those countries. It's causing huge increases in prices for everyone, for everything you buy there. It's throwing their economy into a severe recession. And our attitude is, hey, let's speed right over that same cliff.
You wanna
pull your hair out.
John Podesta is in charge now. They brought John Podesta back in. He's got $370 billion to hand out. Come on, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, and the first check is going to be written to his brother, Tony Podesta.
Right. Sure, why not?
Hey, what does he know about
climate
change?
If you can't help your brother, who can you help? So, for example.
Anyway, I just want to be clear to people. Yeah. We're not talking about $370 million.
No, billion.
We're talking about $370 billion.
Exactly. We're talking about the same number. We're talking about the same number of dollars that as jobs created under Joe Biden, according to Karine Jean-Pierre. She's created 370 billion jobs, I think she said.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there anybody in the White House who's a business person? I mean, they have all these, professors
political
and educators,
yeah, right.
Anybody that knows
no,
anything?
Well, we did the study on that about a month and a half ago, and it showed that the average person in the finance and economics and transportation and commerce has median is 0 years of business experience. So I think Podesta would probably, well, it depends. If you're running a big political consulting firm, Dan, does that qualify as being a businessman?
I don't know.
kind of qualifies as being
academia.
A grifter. I don't know if it qualifies as being a businessman.
But hey, I really want to get close to Podesta with all that money to hand out. I want some of that.
No kidding. And you're not the only one. A lot of people in Chicago, they pay attention when somebody's got a big checkbook. Particularly if it's the public's checkbook. Marcus Evans, he's a state rep here. He is one of the co-sponsors of the no cash bail legislation that's going to turn all of Illinois into the lawless shooting gallery that is Chicago. But he's got other big ideas, too. He wants to build a wind farm on Lake Michigan. The state rep, wind farm on Lake Michigan. about 10 miles from the shores of the Southeast Side, because that's a real job creator, he says. Not to mention, it'll bump up the percentage of power we receive from wind, which right now is about 3% as compared to 34% from nuclear, 22% from coal, fossil fuels, 38% from natural gas. We get 3% from wind, but that's not going to change. Now, he did note, and it is noted, there is a bit of a technical problem with a Great Lakes wind farm idea. It's called winter.
What's that?
It's called winter.
So in winter, when metal freezes.
So we're going to have to spend a lot of money to overcome that technical problem, Steve.
Well, yeah, because it freezes, right?
We have low temperatures.
But, you know, but this is a serious point, though. I mean, and I'm writing a column on this. When did this happen where climate change became like a cult? It's a cult on the left. I mean, that's all they care about is climate change. And, of course, racial injustice. Those are their two big things. But, you know, Gal Gore came up with this crazy idea, 30 years ago or something. And all of a sudden, I mean, you can't even run for local dog catcher as a Democrat if you don't buy into this creed, which is so, I mean, the idea that somehow we're going to save the world by building wind farms, it's so completely absurd. It's like, you want to knock these people on the side of the head and say, come on, what are you talking about? We still get 72% of the world's energy from fossil fuels. We get like 5% from these other sources, and they want to try to flip that immediately, and it's going to cause huge problems. Look, I'm really worried right now about what's going on with the overall U.S. economy. It looks like it's really stalling out quickly. You look at the manufacturing numbers, terrible. You look at the construction numbers, terrible. You look at the housing numbers, terrible. You look at the small business numbers, terrible. This economy is really, really floundering right now. And we did get a decent jobs report on Friday, but I hope I'm wrong about this, but I think you're going to start to see layoffs. You're going to start to see businesses cutting off their hiring, because the economy, Europe is already in a severe recession. Japan's right in a recession, and where's the growth going to come from? I mean, tell me one thing, Amy, that Joe Biden has done on the economy that's pro-growth, that's going to inspire companies to build. And it gets to this point, you know, we're laughing about this $300 billion slush fund, and that's what it is. It's a slush fund for John Podesta to pass out to his political cronies. But even if it weren't, when did we start believing that people in government can make better investment decisions than, you know, what makes the capitalism system work in America is that we're incredibly good at allocating capital to its highest, return uses. The government doesn't do that. When have they ever done a good job of that? Remember Solyndra?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, this is the left's. This is, and then the left, the corporatists will say, well, what about Tesla? I mean, the left has always believed that. This has always been the divide. It's just that more and more on the center right have been co-opted by all the money that can be gained through rent seeking. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, many Republicans voted for that crazy, what do they call the chips bill
infrastructure.
We're going to save the economy by giving, $100 billion to Samsung and what's the other big chip maker?
Intel.
Intel, yeah. And so, I mean, that's not the way a capitalist system works.
Is this the way it works? Having a Politburo for fast food worker wages in California to set their hourly wage? You know, as I was talking to this guy who runs a restaurant on the Tony North Shore, where you grew up as a child of privilege, which is how you become a MAGA extremist.
So apologize right now.
I'm a one percenter.
I know.
Shame on you.
He's paying, and it's a very successful restaurant. He's paying his dishwasher $28 an hour.
What?
And I said, it's great to know I have something to fall back on if this radio thing goes south, because that's pretty
good.
Holy
cow, that's great money.
And he's still getting, and you talk to any restaurateur, they're still getting held up like, the guy across the street is offering me $28.50. So, you got to keep going because there's so few people want to work. And now you're going to artificially increase wages through things like these, minimum wage laws or these Politburo price setters. salary setters.
Yeah. So you're going to, you know, it's amazing when you go to fast food restaurants now, hard to find anybody to serve you. It's all being done by robots now. And, you know, and that's, yeah, that's kind of the future, because they can't afford to. I mean,
it's like when the caddies got replaced by golf carts at Bushwick.
How do you make money selling a $4 Whopper if you have to pay people $24 an hour, well, you know, to serve you?
It's not going to be a $4 Whopper.
That doesn't work.
Yeah. Right. The cost is going to be pushed onto the consumer. And then.
Of course. That's of course. And so, look, why can't we just get back to free market policies?
Nope.
I mean, oh, there's good news. Chile, did you see that happened in Chile? We talked about this in months past.
Yeah.
But they rejected this Marxist constitutional change. So the Chileans finally get it that, you know, maybe moving towards Marxism isn't such a great idea. But Americans don't seem to get that.
Well, yeah, it does seem to be a struggle. We just cannot stop, at least in some places, we cannot stop ourselves from gravitating to the promise of being bribed with our own money. We just can't do it. I mean, we've got all kinds of silly gambits going on in the metro area, as you know, Steve, from reparations in Evanston to universal basic income pilot programs in the city of Chicago.
Well, I'll say this, you know, that you have the, I think, the second or third worst governor in America, objectively speaking.
Yeah.
And yet, you think he's not the second or third?
I think
I think he's the worst.
Yeah, I think he's the worst.
Okay. Well, you guys are right there on the seat. But my point is, let's say he's in the bottom three. We can agree on that. So why, I mean, he's ruining the state of Illinois. People are moving out. Every time I go to North Carolina or I go to Florida or I go to Arizona, all I see is Illinois license plates. And if the people in Illinois still vote for this doofus, that's, you know, then it's not Pritzker's fault. It's the idiots who vote for him. It's the people of Illinois who bought into this concept that, you know, can't people see what's happening to their state?
Well, let me answer that question this way. What do you think the approval rating for Joe Biden is in Illinois right now?
45.
49.
49.
That split.
That is,
I mean, here's a guy who's done, literally, I mean, you can't think of anything he's done right. The border is a catastrophe. Afghanistan was a catastrophe. The crime rates are a catastrophe. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, inflation is a catastrophe. The economy is a catastrophe. What the hell has he done right? What do you approve of?
I don't
he's
know.
Not Donald Trump?
You're vastly underestimating the number of walking dead in the Chicago metro area, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, well,
so
it
we'll
also
keep fighting.
Means you've got a lot of people living on government assistance.
Yes.
People like the free money.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Steve Moore, economist.
There's a hold on. There's a tipping point. At some point, there's not enough people paying in to pay all.
Well, yeah, but then you just continue to pile up on secured debt. You know, I mean, that's what we do. We got $500 billion in unsecured debt now. I mean, why don't we just keep going? Just like the printing presses in D.C., the MMTers want to keep going. You know how that goes. Steve Moore, we're out of time and out of optimism. Govzilla author and economist. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Bye, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So coming out of Labor Day, we're spanning the state and region. Talk to candidates in key statewide, congressional, get to some regional and local races too, hopefully. Yesterday, we talked to Shannon Teresi. She's the Republican nominee for comptroller against Mendoza. And Keith Peacow is running for Congress against incumbent noxious Democrat socialist D-bag Sean Casten. And today, we talked to Tom DeBoer, who's the Republican nominee for attorney general, running against incumbent Kwame Raoul.
And it's not that – it's pretty tight of a race.
He's single digits against Raoul, so it's doable. We'll see how the national landscape impacts the state and local. It's improved a little bit for Democrats from a month or so ago. So they have gotten some temporary reprieve, but as long as things continue to deteriorate. Not that I'm cheering it, but you're just describing it, as you heard Steve Moore describing it before the break. It's going to be a difficult November for Democrats, including congressional Democrats, including House Democrats, which leads us to our next candidate, although he's in a much more difficult district than some of the downstate pickup opportunities and even suburban opportunities like Keith Pikow, I believe, but perhaps he'll convince us otherwise. He's running in Illinois 10 against incumbent Brad Schneider, who is a complete non-entity. Mainly, from what I can tell, Brad Schneider has just been riding his bike around the district for about the past decade or so. As he was on again, off again, when he was going back and forth, who was holding the district, him or Bob Dold.
He spoke at my sister's school and he asked kids, you know, why don't you ask me what my favorite color is? And so everyone's looking around and says, okay. What's your favorite color? And guess what his response was? I like pink.
Uh-huh.
Because it's an inclusive color. It's not just for girls.
Yeah, I was going to guess, pasty white. That's what I was going to guess. But okay, sure, we'll go with pink. Whatever you say, Brad. His challenger is a Republican named Joe Severino. More information on his candidacy, SeverinoForCongress.com, SeverinoForCongress.com. Joe Severino joins us now. Joe, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. So the North Shore has not exactly been hospitable to people with an R next to their name of late. Why is this race doable? Why should people be paying attention to your contest against Schneider?
I thought Brad's favorite color would have been a taupe or something.
Yes, beige, very
he
bland.
He wants to be woke,
yes,
okay?
Right, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, the North Shore, I do agree. First of all, the district was redrawn, and it was very, very favorable, the redrawing. They thought that Brad Schneider was so safe as an incumbent that they could stretch the district, and they included a lot of the red population.
What region of the district do you think this turns on? Give us a couple communities where, you know, if I win these communities or win them by a particular margin, then I can spring this upset.
Well, I'm a resident of Lake Forest, so I do realize Moraine, which encompasses Deerfield, Highland Park, Northbrook, Lake Forest, Libertyville, all these areas concentrated on the North Shore. But Dan, the way we reach them is by being a populist candidate with a populist message. You don't have to sacrifice your conservative values in order to run a business as a district. So as I'm getting out there and letting people understand that, and I'll give you an idea. So pro-life is a big one for them in the districts where we need to make an impact. And when you let them know, I ran a business for 25 years. I've never had a conversation about abortion with any of my workers, and I don't intend to throughout the district. I don't think it's something that should be celebrated. However, like Bill Clinton said, it should be rare, safe, and the taxpayer shouldn't pay for it. So if you approach it in a more non-invasive, if you have a more non-invasive approach to not harming individuals or the rights that they want to keep intact and bring more of a business mentality to the district, they warm up to you very quickly, and that's what I'm finding. It's just been phenomenal for me in the candidacy. I have not been spending time in the traditional Republican huddling at Republican event after Republican event. I had a coffee with 37 Democrats, and when I left, more than half of them were saying, this is somebody I can vote for. So if you bring a message of experience and authenticity, you can garner up the base that normally wouldn't be there for you.
Well, now a lot of people want to know, who are you? Tell us about yourself.
So my biography is a little different. So I grew up in Cicero, Illinois.
Dan's old stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, but, right. You know, the reality is it
so did Joe Montaigne, by the way, so, you know.
That's true.
Yes, of course. Freddy's, I know well. So long and short of, and I have a theater and film background too, but at the end of the day, growing up in Cicero, like I said, fighting every day of my life, the value you bring from that, it just calluses you up in a different way. And for me, you know, being bullied,
you learn to, you know, it just kind of builds you different. You're less apologetic in your approach to fighting on behalf of others. And that's something I've already started. I've been fighting, you know, some of the Illinois GOP.
Wait. Being bullied in Cicero has a different sort of connotation than being bullied in Lake Forest. So, what exactly happened in your childhood? I mean, I think it's interesting. Childhood in Cicero?
Okay, so, you know, at 9, 10 years old, it wasn't uncommon to come home with a black eye. I can't tell you how many times my nose has been broken, you know, your head cracked open, as we used to say.
Yeah.
You would have gang fights. I was never a part of the gang, but, you know, if you weren't, it was sometimes even worse for you because it was a free-for-all. And, you know, I started boxing at a young age. And then after being bullied, by the time I was 18 years old, I was offered to fight professionally. So I know what it's like to grow through adversity. And, like I said, 9 or 10 years old, if you want to talk about racism, discrimination, et cetera, if you were, Roosevelt Road, 16th Street, all those main arteries through Cicero, you know, if a black person drove down the street, they'd, you know, Molotov cocktails, they'd throw boulders off a viaduct. I mean, it was so dangerous. And then when you see people being harmed out there in these suffering communities, and you know you can bring a leadership component and change the trajectory almost overnight, there's a compulsion to want to get out there and serve, and that's why I'm running.
So is boxing your sort of way out of some rough and tumble neighborhoods and then into school and business, or what was your path?
I boxing gave me the confidence to be able to maybe believe in myself. I had great mentors around me that helped navigate my life as a young, I think at 9 years old, the Cicero Stadium is where I think his name was Dino Trisca was the boxing coach at the time. And that's what, after already being successful in business for about 25 years, Dan, I started a children's foundation.
So you started boxing and then you built this career that lands you in Lake Forest. I think that's just an interesting, you know, sort of uniquely American story.
Yes, certainly. So what worked for me was boxing was just a kind of a minority component as to what I was doing. I was a young entrepreneur. I stopped boxing because I got involved in the film business, worked for Magnum Clearwater Films, casting locations throughout Chicago, continuity directing throughout Chicagoland area. And then in tandem, I had my parking company, which I grew from a $1,000 check from my father into the largest singly owned parking / hospitality company in Illinois, which is incredibly competitive. Unions, you name it. And we thrive and actually kind of scale the unique model that's being emulated now. So after doing that, and being successful, I decided that, you know, I did move to Lake Forest. I was living in Park Ridge. I moved to Lake Forest. We adopted. I have 5 children, 4 girls from 19 to 3 are their ages. And living in Lake Forest, my children's foundation that I built while running my company, and by the way, I went to law school and Harvard Business School, celebrated OPM program while I was doing all this. So it's always about self-growth. It's always about being philanthropic, always about giving back. And so I started through being very thankful, my children's foundation, and COVID came. It, disallowed kids from getting together. We had professional athletes, almost like a leadership program, coaching these kids, and we would have them come from, you know, the West Side, 95th and Stony, come to Park Ridge. We would blur all racial and, you know, any divisive line and get kids out there playing together. It was just wonderful. Well, when we were no longer able to do that, I decided to run for Congress, and that's why I'm here now. I believe I bring a sophisticated component of leadership with a biography, literally from the street to the boardroom. I've been very successful. It's proven. And I'm running against a guy that's absolutely dangerous for our community here. So
COVID, the lockdowns from COVID inspired you to run for office? Because I know there's a lot of people that happened to.
Absolutely. In an absence of, other things to do. Once my foundation was no longer operable because
we couldn't gather, they stymied the children from, you know, a lot of it was children's sports. So they couldn't play sports. I had downtime. I didn't feel comfortable sitting around. So I decided to run. In 2020, I tried to run as an independent because they were basically running a liberal against a liberal. And I said, you know, who's balancing things out on the other side here? So I tried to run as somebody that was, you know, anti-reparations, pro-Trump's policies. And within 3 weeks, I almost got on the ballot. And since then, I became infatuated with, you know, the ability to bring a voice that people really believe in to the district. And because our district, it is unique, Dan, as you said. So we're probably one of the most educated, wealthy, and philanthropic in the nation. So when you bring a message to the people that not only do you recognize and understand their values, but this is how we can expand on them and bring others along, it's just been fantastic, the reception.
All right. He is Joe Severino. He is a Republican nominee for Congress in Illinois 10, running against incumbent Brad Schneider. For more info on his campaign, SeverinoForCongress.com. That's SeverinoForCongress.com. Joe Severino, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you, Amy. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and good luck to you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So over the weekend, this horrific mass murder occurred in Weldon, Saskatchewan. The 13 locations on the James Smith Cree Nation community, 19 or 18 people were injured, 11 people were murdered, mass stabbing, two suspects, brothers, one is dead, was found dead, the other is still at large. Boy, we haven't, that's a lot of people injured and murdered in one fell swoop. Don't have a handle on motive, at least that I've read at this point. Some people appear to have been targeted while others were randomly attacked. Golly, I sure wish one of those law-abiding individuals would have had a gun.
Maybe we should ban knives.
For more on this, pleased to be joined by John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, and he's the author of Gun Control Myths, as well as More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to talk to you guys again.
Well, I haven't seen much chatter on this on the cable news programs about this mass killing in Canada. Where's that grade school drama teacher who they made prime minister to give us chapter and verse on knives and their usage in Canada? In fact, I think I remember there was a move to register knives in Canada under this guy, wasn't there?
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, you're being a little bit facetious, but
just a little bit.
Yeah. Look, there's certain types of crimes that fit kind of the media narrative in terms of what they like to cover, and there are other ones that don't. So if you have, something like the SUV that ran through the Christmas crowd, killing seven and injuring over 60 the end of last year, that doesn't get a lot of coverage. If you have something like a black racist or something killing people, that quickly disappears from the news. If you have an instance where a law-abiding citizen uses a gun to stop a crime, to stop what would have been clearly a mass public killing, that may get it some initial news, but it quickly goes away or quickly leads to the media trying to assure everybody that those types of instances are much rarer than they actually are. So, unfortunately, the media drives a lot of the political debate that we have right now. And, it's able to go and stir up people in certain ways. But here's the bottom line for the Canada thing, and that is, look, guns do make it easier to kill people, but they also make it easier for people to protect themselves and prevent bad things from happening. And, you know, I kind of worry that the media coverage and a lot of this stuff will actually lead to more deaths because they ignore obvious things like these. When you have these mass public shootings, how they virtually always involve gun-free zones. They ignore the manifestos or diaries that these murderers leave where they explain why they picked gun-free zones in order to go and do their attacks. But unfortunately, even if they're covering the contents of the diaries or manifestos very selectively, they seem to leave out those particular parts all the time.
Yeah, like here in Chicago over the Labor Day weekend, 55 shot, 11 fatally in 3 days. And they're touting that, oh, but we recovered 157 illegal guns off the streets this weekend. So what do you recommend for Chicago? Is there any help in saving us?
Well, I wouldn't have cut like the 400 police officer positions in 2020 that Mayor Lightfoot cut. I wouldn't have you have a district attorney that you have who's refusing to prosecute many violent criminals there with Kim Fox. Look, this isn't rocket science. When Mayor Daley, the younger, became mayor of Chicago, the arrest rates for murder in Chicago were 67%. When he left, when Rahm Emanuel became mayor, it was down to 30%. When Rahm Emanuel left, it was down to 20%. And since then, it's been as low as like 12%, though it's up a little bit again now. It's still way below the national average. It's way below what it was when Mayor Daley became mayor. And there are lots of very obvious things that Chicago politicians have done over the decades that have made it very difficult for police to go and do their jobs. I mean, look at some of the agreements that Rahm Emanuel made. He made an agreement with the ACLU that every time a police officer goes and talks to somebody, they have to fill out 2 legal pages of forms with small print that takes any place from like 45 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes for them to fill it out for each person. So you go and talk to 4 people in the morning, the entire afternoon is taken up with police officers doing paperwork. That's effectively just removing police officers. When Rahm Emanuel was mayor, one of the first things he did was he closed down the police bureaus in the highest murder rates parts of the city. I mean, they still tried to solve it, but now you had to have detectives going and traveling up to like 45 minutes in some cases to get to the crime scene. He moved police from being stationed in high crime areas to low crime areas because he had made promises in his initial election that were there. So, look, if you want to reduce crime, you want to make it risky for criminals to go and commit crime. And there are different ways you can do that. You can have higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences. You can also make it easier for law-abiding citizens to protect themselves. But in Chicago, you know, if you add up the licensing fee and the training costs that are there, you're talking about over $400 for people to go through the process to get a concealed carry permit. You know, you compare Illinois to Indiana, and Illinois, just over 4% of the adult population has a concealed carry permit. In Indiana, it's 22%. And not only that, but who gets a permit? In Illinois, it's primarily wealthy people who live in the suburbs. In Indiana, it's much more people who live in high crime areas. Well, guess what? You know, I'm glad that the people in the wealthy suburbs have concealed carry permits in Illinois, but they're not the ones who need it the most.
Right.
And, you know, the big difference is that up until recently, it cost $12.95 to get a permit in Indiana, the entire cost, versus over $400 in Illinois. Is it surprising that You have a lot more poor minorities who go and get permits in Indiana than you get in Illinois. So they make it so it's not risky in many different ways for criminals. And, you know, unfortunately, I think Biden kind of reflects these types of policies in his speech last week.
His speech last week in Pennsylvania, that was something I learned that the main problem, it seems, to Biden and thus to the nation, main problem seems to be these gun dealers. They're the real problem in America. It's the gun dealers, and also these and of course the weapons of war. And he made up a bunch of features about AR-15s that actually, he made them up. They're not true, but they sounded scary.
You're telling me that the bullet from an AR-15 doesn't travel five times faster than for any other gun? I thought for sure I'd learned that from him. But anyway, there are lots of issues. Am I glad that Biden has come around on the number of police? Yeah, I think it's useful to have more police. The problem is that police are only one part of the legal system. And look, $13 billion more for police and training, though I'm not sure what the training is going to be covering. It's just a fraction of the $80 billion he wants to go and spend on hiring new IRS agents. But it still can be valuable. The problem is Biden refuses to recognize the fact that you have Democratic district attorneys around the country like Kim Fox who are refusing to prosecute violent criminals. You have had liberal judges around the country, including the Chicago area, which have left out many urban areas, over half the inmates from jail over the last couple of years. You've had bail reform occurring across the country where criminals are let out. Look, you can arrest people, but one of the things that's been frustrating for police in the United States is that as soon as they arrest people, they're put out on the street again. And so, Biden's unwillingness to go and criticize Democrats across the country who are making it impossible to keep people in jail just shows that the overall approach isn't a serious one that's there.
He is John Lott. He's the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and staff at the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy. He's the author of Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime as well. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being there. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Just one point. I like the way, I just call him Tiny Dancer, so I'm not going to adopt it, but I like the way that John Lott pronounced Rahm Emanuel's name. Emmanuel.
Emmanuel, welcome to me, Emmanuel.
No, I wasn't thinking. I was not thinking religious. I was thinking like French porn. Like a late night movie on Cinemax. Emmanuel.
Yeah. So that's what you do with your time.
Emmanuel, yeah. I should say.
Emmanuel, yeah. You know, Mr. Emmanuel.
That's what I've heard about. Yeah, anyway.
Yes.
All right.
The new ambassador to Japan.
So a triple threat tackled the Bears yesterday. I assume they're staying. Everything's fine.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well, she thinks. She's like, no, if. She's still holding out hope. She's like that desperate high school girlfriend who doesn't want to break up with the star quarterback.
We were going to make a very compelling case for them to stay in the city of Chicago, and I think that we've done that. And we're going to continue our discussions. We're going to continue our discussions. Excuse me, with the league. But as you know, I'm somebody who likes to plan. So we've got plan B, plan C, and others in the works as well if the Bears decide that they're going to abandon the city of Chicago. I hope they don't, and we're going to keep fighting that fight as long as we possibly can.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA. Then a quick comment.
She sounded sad. She said, if the Bears decide they're going to abandon Chicago, that does sound like a jilted.
I know, a jilted
doesn't.
Lover.
Yeah,
I mean, it was so bad on her watch as mayor
abandoned.
That even the Bears left.
I was,
you know,
I was abandoned.
She doesn't want that on her record.
That's
no,
of course.
Permanent stain. Like Chicago's so dangerous, has the worst, you know, run city that even the Chicago Bears moving out of Chicago.
Is that why the Bears are leaving? They don't feel safe at Soldier
Field?
Yeah,
exactly.
I don't think
so. No, I just think that it's finally their time
to... Justin Fields shouldn't be feeling safe at Soldier Field with that line. I would understand that. But no, they're not. Yeah, I don't think so. I
think they want... They're sick of renting.
So
okay?
when do they sell the corporate rights to the Obama Presidential Library and like make it... Yeah,
what
like
do you mean?
You know, Obama... Like just a stadium would be another feature in Obama land.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's a 362-acre land and they're going to have...
So what?
So, well, they're going to have schools. They're going to have apartments. They're going to have condos. They're going to have hotels. It's going to change Arlington Heights. This is Arlington.
Oh,
when they move to Arlington
Heights.
Heights.
Yeah, I was there.
About the new renovations to keep the Bears.
She was talking about Plan B and Plan C. I want to hear all the details because she's such a planner. She didn't get caught flat-footed on this. No, not at all. That's why at the beginning she was all tough talk and they should worry about trying to beat the Packers, not worry about where they're going to play football. And now it's all Plan B and Plan C, and I'm being abandoned. So what are Plan B and Plan C?
Well, she didn't answer what her Plan B and Plan C
are. She has them. They're secret.
They're secret plans.
Secret Plan B.
Because she has one of theirs. She's like, well, we know what they are, but we're working on them. Because they have to attract. Well, she wants to keep the Bears here by expanding the stadium, putting a dome over it. you know, having a fresh air market, some nightlife.
You know what would keep the Bears at Soldier Field is a farmer's market.
Well, on Saturdays, you know, and then on Sundays.
What you need. You need a farmer's market. That's all.
But the Bears are going to have a huge meeting tomorrow night in Arlington Heights from 7 and 9 p.m. Doors open at 5 p.m. at John Hersey High School. That's where I went to school.
Yeah, well, and sure they're going to be paying homage to your
Wall of Fame.
Wall of Fame entry, yeah.
With the Peter Frampton here. But that's when they're going to hear from residents. They say they're going to, it's going to create 48,000 jobs, $9.4 billion economic impact to the region.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, you know, but if they build
But
if they build this, because this is, you know, a rendition of what it would look like in Arlington Heights, old Arlington Park.
Uh-huh.
NCAA Final Four championships, Super Bowls, you name it, we could host it. It could be an entertainment mecca.
Oh, yeah.
Of Illinois.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I know. Big dreams. Everybody's got big dreams. The only sticking point is just going to be making sure that it's all private money. Arlington Heights residents don't want it publicly financed. Neither do I. Neither should state taxpayers. You've got a great piece of land there. You can do something very special. You can attract the private investment necessary. That's what the Bears should do. That's what they're going to do. Bye-bye.
She's not ready to say goodbye.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. In this relationship, the Bears have a say too. So you can call it abandonment.
Is it me or is it you?
We're just going our separate ways, but you can call it abandonment if you want. You can call it whatever you want, but we'll see in Arlington Heights because that's what's going to happen.
My God.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.